The Mice and the Guinea Pigs That Built Science. This is Peter Hill Explains, where we have, hopefully, a conversation about science which gets you interested in it. I, myself, am interested in oxygen, so the story I'm going to tell you about it will delve into the animals behind oxygen, the animals involved in the building of oxygen. Now, myself, what's made me curious a little bit about oxygen is why there is so much oxygen on the Earth's surface and why there's comparatively, compared to the oxygen in the Earth's crust and other things, the elements either side of it, there's very little of. There's a lot of nitrogen in the atmosphere because that's inert. There's a lot of oxygen in the rocks of Earth. So there's heaps of oxide. Everything's oxide. And then there's very little fluorine. In fact, there's 1,000 times less nitrogen or fluorine, molecule per molecule, than oxygen. So oxygen's really abundant. And this has got myself really interested. And then there's certain laws of abundances. So if you look at the abundances of various elements in the periodic table, they tend to sawtooth and go to maximums. Look in the stability of various nuclei. So if a nucleus is very stable when it's been produced in the sun, there's a lot of it. And oxygen's like that. And there's this sort of magic law that something's more abundant if it's got a multiple of helium nuclei in it. And if you look at it, I've forgotten what two helium nuclei together are, but probably beryllium. Beryllium would be two nuclei, and then you have carbon, which are three helium nuclei. But when you get four helium nuclei, you get something which is super stable and super abundant. So that's why there's a lot of oxygen in it. So that's of interest to me because I've been fascinated by oxygen oxide layers on metals. Are absolutely fascinating. They're the technology which we can do with oxides on metals, and just metal oxides is just mind-blowing what you can do with it. So I was just interested in why we have so much oxygen and we don't have, say, magnesium fluoride or things of that nature. You know, what's going on with it? Well, we have a lot of sodium chloride in the oceans because it's very soluble. So the oxides are not as soluble as the chloride, so that's why there's so many chlorides in the ocean. But in general, it's the oxides which are really fascinating. So as I promised, we'd go back and discuss animals. Now, the use of animals in discussing science has been a really problematic one. So at the time before they invented the word scientist for Faraday, they tried to teach children about science by teaching about Newton and his love of his animals. They tended to teach that a little bit. And we'll talk a bit about it, but the more people got to know Newton, even small children say, "Hey, Mum, Newton's a little bit weird." And indeed, when you do look at it, he was a little bit weird, and really you have to do something like read his original books in Latin, and it's actually possible to actually crash through it with a little bit of splattering of school Latin and a little bit of help from Google Translate. You tend to get the highlights of Newton in translations, English translations, but if you actually crash through his books, it's actually just mind-boggling to see how complicated they are and what avenues they follow up. But let's talk about Newton. Newton's had several annals, and it's good to talk about him because he didn't discover gases or things to do with elements and that happened 150 years after Newton, easily after Newton. But he did have a mouse called Miller Mouse, who he put in a toy windmill, and actually is credited with invention of the little mouse round cage. The mouse would run around with it. And he used to dress up the mouse, apparently. And then later on, so that's a story, and obviously people back before in the 1820s who have been educated would be told the story, and obviously it would be a bit more embellished to it. There's another very, very famous story where Newton had all his, and we should point out that Newton was a member of the Church of England, that it was very important to be in the Church of England to have access to education. That's an important point we're going to use later on in our story. And Newton had a little puppy dog called Diamond. We know it's his name of this particular puppy dog called Diamond because Diamond used to keep this rather reclusive, hard to understand man in, I think it was in Cambridge. Yeah, I think Cambridge, definitely Cambridge. And so when he was going off to prayers, and the important thing to understand is that although the basis of Newton is a very religious belief, he believed that he was uncovering the forces of God. In terms of his explanation of gravity was that God looked at this mass and God looked at that mass, and then he did the calculation and actually God pushed the masses together. When you really unpeel everything, Newton, everything, when he really didn't make a big step beyond analysing how God operated, if you read it. But we go back to his dog called Diamond, and his dog called Diamond was left in his room and knocked over a candle which burnt many of his works and burnt them all up. Now, the dog burnt his homework. And there's many cases, when you actually look at it, where Newton goes back and he says, I've done the calculation somewhere and can't find it. I think there's a lot of gravity calculations when he went on to look at it. So there's the Diamond incident. And there's also the very famous incident or story of Newton looking at light through prisms, the early spectroscopy. He is the key person in spectroscopy, which led forward into our modern era. This is getting a prism. You know, the beautiful crystals where you see the different colours and stuff like that. And it's hard to imagine that people associated colours with spirits and religious beliefs. So it's quite an impressive movement across it. And he had the problem that he had a pet cat. We only know about this pet cat because he was able to overcome the problem of his pet cat opening the door and destroying his experiments. And he invented, apparently, the cat flap. And so all of these things are true from many, many sources besides Wikipedia. I've read a few people have written their theses or books on Newton, which are very fascinating to read through. It's Newton may be bizarre, but the way that he's been remembered are particularly bizarre. There's a story of Newton's London laboratory being taken out before the building was destroyed by an American, and apparently it's in the third floor or some floor of an American building in Boston. You can just go up and the lift opens and you're suddenly in this laboratory. I don't know whether that's still there, but that was definitely when this person wrote this book. So there's a lot of bizarre things about how this Newton and how he was processed. And of course, Newton as an architectural, reclusive man of science, natural philosopher, they began to work with that more in the Industrial Revolution, and that's just really didn't work, so people moved more on to another model, which is Faraday afterwards. But I did promise that we would talk about pets and animals which were put their lives on the line for science, and we come up to a person called Joseph Priestley. An English person, and who became a priest. A priestly became a priest, or a minister, as they're called. Now, you've got to remember, there's the Church of England, there's the Calvinists, who are really the extreme Protestants. So the Church of England's were more happy-go-lucky. The Calvinists believe are very puritanical, and the standard large family. Mum gets along a few Presbyterian priests. Now, Presbyterians, I really can't work out all the different varieties. Presbyterians are not Church of England. So this is the important thing, that this priestly who's got a real scientific bent is not going to be able to go to Cambridge and study. And so he likes the Presbyterians, becomes a Presbyterian preacher, but his only access to a called a dissenting college. So these are long since disappeared in England because they've expanded it. Not only the anti-Catholic, they were anti anything else besides Church of England. So in this dissenting college, he had, that's right, I have to remember, I've got so many lords in my head going around. It's Lord Shelburne. So he was basically an experimental scientist and got a job teaching and educating the children of as a sort of a mentor. So this is important to understand. There's no universal schooling, so these teachers got pulled up by their mentors, and he was the mentor for Lord Shelburne. I think it would have been a Lord Shelburne, while he was still doing his priestly duties, and began to do examinations into the heirs. So the idea was that air was a universal element. There was water, air, earth, and fire. They were the basic elements. So at this stage, Priestley, his research takes us from air as an element to air as a mixture of more basic things. We didn't actually get very much further than that one in Priestley, but he began to look at it. And so he began to look at this air called carbon dioxide, which we understand as carbon dioxide, but the air given off by the bubbles of beer, and how he could actually burn stuff and basically carbonate water. And so Priestley, when you have your glass of Coke with your fast food out there, you think that the bubbles in that Coke, as that's really understood, developed by Priestley. But here we come along to where he starts to do some more bizarre experiments the mice come in. We don't know exactly how the mice got there. I haven't really read. There's not as brilliant biographies that you can read as, say, of Franklin or of Faraday or Newton. There's lots of really good works on Newton's. Here I haven't found a really good biography of Priestley, Joseph Priestley, so I can't really talk too much about it, but there's his apparatus and stuff like that. Now, the interesting things is that this is about the time that they were setting off to look for Australia, 1772-76. So Australia was discovered in 1778, and so he was a scientist pick to go with Cook. But you guessed it, he wasn't in the Church of England, so he could only have Church of England people going along in the scientists. And so he's left to be tutor for this Lord Shelburne. So the fundamental idea is that these wealth people were, let's face it, robbing the poor people blind, and therefore had a lot of leisure wealth. It was something very fair. And so this went off to Priestley, so he had a little laboratory. And these wealthy people, and this has happened several times in scientific history, just this is the number of times these scientists get sucked into a European tour as the sidekick for it. So Shelburne, let's wind up. We're going to have Lord Shelburne's going to go on a scientific journey, and he's going to go to revolutionary France. And Priestley's going to be someone who is arguing for the American Revolution and the various revolutions and arguing against religion and arguing himself on a way on a eventually, if you like America so much, if you don't love us, you can leave us. So he eventually goes off to America and spends his final days in America in, I just have to think, not Chicago, Pittsburgh. I've actually visited Pittsburgh once, I think. I can remember seeing two rivers come together in Pittsburgh from a hill. That's all I can remember, basically, as a kid. Okay, so we've got Priestley, Joseph Priestley. He's a tutor. So this is before he goes to Europe. He's experimenting with gases. He's discovered carbon dioxide a bit. And so he's looking at air. And at this stage, air is one of Aristotle's elements for 2,300 years or less, I'd say. Let me calculate that one back. Aristotle, 360, 2,000 years, I'll place it, 2,000 years. Aristotle has put that air is an element, it's indivisible. And so he started to do things. If air is air, I can put a candle in there and it will never burn out. And let's try and actually get your head around the fact of what was chemistry before you had elements. Well, they had this thing called phlogiston, yeah. And so that was the element of fire. And that was in stuff. And in fact, it's hard to get your mind around it. It was in fire. And then the phlogiston came out and you could see it. Quite obviously, it looks as though you light a something. If you had to ask someone who wasn't indoctrinated with modern chemistry, they'd probably come up with these solutions. So I get some fuel, and the fire comes out of it, and it gets to ash. And so the ash stuff is something called calx, C-A-L-X. So you've got something with the phlogiston in it, which is normal, and something with the phlogiston taken out of it, and that's calx, sort of a back-to-front way chemistry actually operates, but it actually operates quite well. So if you have a problem, I light a candle, and you put it in a bell jar, and you can do this, you can get a cup and put it over a candle, and the carbon, we understand that the carbon dioxide builds out and runs out of oxygen. No. What happens is that this air, as far as they thought, gets full of phlogiston, and phlogiston can no longer come out of the substance. You can see that sort of idea, that phlogiston is being gassed off and it builds up to an equilibrium, and so no longer comes out. So the gas comes, the candle comes out. Now here we come to the first mice, and I don't think this mouse has a name, and I think you might be able to guess what happens. He puts the mouse inside the air chamber, and the mouse with a candle inside it, and after so many hours or so, the mouse is just not a happy mouse anymore. It's sort of breathing, I suppose you'd see it missed out a bit, and the mouse again and suffocates. Now, what it's going on, because it's got air, there's obviously air that's running out, and so it's still got air, so what's different about this new air? So the mouse is inside there, and you light the candle, and the candle goes out, and the mouse goes out as well. So he was beginning to work out what was going on. So this, it's still got air in there, but that air is different. So it's still painful to go through. So push comes to shove, and he did this experiment. Of course, the mouse didn't come back to life, but with a plant inside. And we don't know quite... Oh, we start to know how this is done in terms of that... the base was either sealed with water or also with mercury. So there's heaps and buckets of mercury around the place. And so you can possibly imagine that he uses to light a candle inside a bell jar. I think the story must be, because he didn't have, or he did do papers on electricity and stuff like that, but he got a watch glass, a magnifying glass, and used the sun's rays to heat up the candle, get it burning, and then it would burn out all within a jar. Quite sophisticated. He may have done something else, but that's what, looking at all the experiments, I think that's what he did. But what can happen is that he had a plant in there for a while, and the plant regenerated the air. So he really has discovered the first photosynthesis experiment, that the sunlight on the plant produces the plant, as far as he was concerned, was taking on phlogiston and dephlogistonating the air. Okay, so he was on the way to working out what's going on, and then he got some mercury, and if you heat up mercury in air, it can actually turn into, even though it's a fairly silvery stuff, it does oxidize and form mercury oxide, which is this red, I think it's called fulminate for some reason, the name is, I don't remember, I have to go. So it's this red, crystally stuff, and it's lighter than mercury. So you can get a bit of this and actually sit it in the mercury in a bell jar with your candle and with your mouse. And what happens is if you get your magnifying glass and heat up this mercury oxide, the mercury oxide, mercury doesn't like being oxidized, it actually releases the oxygen. So I think you can actually just, I think you can actually just get this as a particular way of getting mercury, get it in the mercury powder form and heat it up, and there you've got mercury. I don't know how, I'll have to really go into it. This is where reading the notes and experiments, you grind through and you work out what's going on. And look, really, 100% I recommend doing that, because you read that first, and then you walk along into a school textbook and you go, your jaw drops down. This is just impossible to understand. Okay, so we've got the mouse, or the candle. In this, it's lit up. It's died down. Then you've got the mercury fulminate, mercury oxide, and you heat it up and it releases oxygen. And there you go. You can relight the candle. Or you can actually have your mouse there, and the mouse, which used to die within an hour, lasted four times as long. If you put it in a pool of mercury, I don't know how this all went. It's all pretty bizarre. But that's not the end of the story for the little animals. There's another animal which gets a pretty, I suppose, dreadful time further up the track. So it's time to keep on listening. And so, with this, he said, da-na-na-na, there's two types of air. And he actually got the quantity of air right. I'm going to have to say something which is of historical significance. So it's historical significance that he's not of the Church of England. He's in dissenting church, so his orbit gets taken out, and he's pushed aside with a lord who takes him to revolutionary France, or pre-revolutionary France. So there's, that's an amazing story there. So there's these other factors in that his other historical thing is the realization that air is not air, the element. Air, like, there's not a periodic table with just, the old periodic table had four elements in it. Now we've got 92 stable ones. And he said, look, there's two types of air. There's dephosgenated air and phlogenated air. One which is always got enough phlogen in it. So if you only just put that in, so there's two types of air, one with it and one without it. And they're two fundamentally different types. So that's what he said. So his oxygen was dephosgenated, so defired air. So oxygen is defired air. So if you put something in oxygen and you light it, the fire comes out of it. And yeah, it does your head in to try and really answer it. But it made perfect sense at the time. So that's a big historical plus. And the English who write the stories say, yep, he discovered oxygen. He discovered something, and he didn't. Oxygen wasn't named yet. That was to come to a more savvy, brilliant person. So this Priestley goes for a journey with his Lord Sheldon's from The Big Bang Theory, Sheldon, and he goes down and he meets the head of the French Academy of Science, and this is Lavoisier. Now, Lavoisier, I could describe what happens to his guinea pig, but let's say, describe what happens to him in... Okay, the French Revolution takes a little bit to get off. They get upset, they go to Versailles, they make it basically a constitutional monarchy, keep the king going up, and then eventually get fed up with the king, and they appoint a king killer, and they kill the king with a guillotine, and once the genie's out of the bottle, they start killing a whole lot of people. It's called the Terror, the Reign of Terror. So people have French laws. So at this point in time, Lavoisier is sort of a superhero of mine because he invented the metric system, and I love units. So Lavoisier gets eventually the chop, but not before he gets convicted along with 30 people get convicted, and he's one of them, and they get convicted for defrauding the French nation, supporting foreigners. I've heard this before, keep the foreigners out, supporting foreigners, and adulterating tobacco. Now, when you actually look into the story, Lavoisier did things we'll have to go up a few steps. I just want to do the guillotining stuff. So they did... you got the guillotine, so I promise to describe things more. So the guillotine is a gravity-assisted axe, which is on a guide rail, on a set of rails, and it's released at the top, and you get a conversion of potential energy to kinetic energy. The axe comes down at great speed at an angle and chops off the person's head. They go, it's a great drum roll, and there's all of blood around the place, and dogs come up and eat the blood and all that type of stuff, and the head comes out and they hang off the head, and there's a bit of a drum roll, and it's a very sort of famous thing. Everyone knows that the guillotine was a medical invention, or some sort of invention. It's named after the inventor. So it's a chop, and so they had the tobacco adultery. Well, it's not adultery. They had tobacco, which was controlled for taxation purposes. So you just have to really get your mind around taxation and the fact that France needed to generate a hell of a lot of money. And you had taxation. The taxation was involved in tobacco. And Lavoisier was really a good guy. And... he added just the right amount of moisture to keep the tobacco good, and added a bit of ash to the tobacco to improve it, but he didn't charge anyone anything more. So the documentation came out that really he shouldn't have lost his head by it, but he did, and he had there's some other 29 people, I think it was, who just got their head chopped, and I shudder to think what it would be like. It be whether you want to go first or last. Last, you have the longest amount of time, but last, it's the most sickening feeling as your head gets chopped off. Now, it's rather interesting in that they had so many, you had so many heads rolling around, and they picked the wrong head to sketch or whatever it is, and someone's they have a statue for Lavoisier, which has had the wrong head put on it because of all this head chopping off. So we know that Lavoisier is going to get the chop. I'll firstly describe what he did to this guinea pig. Oh, well, firstly, so Lavoisier, before we do the guinea pig, we'll do the phlogiston experiment. So Priestley came on. So Priestley, he really didn't explain to Lavoisier it was a great thing, and Lavoisier repeated this experiment, and this experiment where you heat mercury mercury oxide with a magnifying glass in a bell jar and produce oxygen was a favourite of Priestley, and it was also a favourite of Lavoisier. Lavoisier was a measurer, and so he was actually able to measure things get heavier. When you burnt them, they got heavier. So it means that the ash is actually heavier. So he burnt phosphorus and sulfur and various things. And why he was burning it, we'll explain a little bit later. So he burnt this, and he, again, I think another story that they poured water down the hot iron barrel, iron tube, and when you heat up iron a lot and just pour steam in it, it produces, dissociates, that the iron oxidizes the water so powerfully that hydrogen is produced. So they're able to produce this gas called hydrogen, and they're able to produce oxygen. So now Lavoisier named hydrogen because it mixed with oxygen to make water. So the origin of the word hydrogen, named Lavoisier, newly discovered, it means the water that makes hydrogen. And now, oxygen, Lavoisier burnt, I think, phosphorus or sulfur with it and made acid. So oxygen, actually, he invented the word oxygen for it, but invented, he believed oxygen comes from the word to make acid. So I have read so many different books. I'm just pulling facts from all of them. So look, don't blame me. It's blame the books if they're wrong for it. So Lavoisier, by just looking at things and measuring, it came up with the law of mass conservation. So this is just before development of full-on chemistry, and we're just beginning to get a few atoms. We don't quite have atoms, but we've got substances coming together. I don't know who discovered fixed ratios of stuff like that. Could have been Lavoisier. So Lavoisier discovered this, and then he was interested in combustion. We'll get back to why he was interested in combustion. But here, as I promised, the guinea pig. Now, the guinea pig comes involved, and let me firstly describe. He wanted to work out that this process was of combustion was using up oxygen, producing carbon dioxide, which he was able to look at, and also generating heat. So to look at heat, he built a ice calorimeter, which involved snow and ice and a gap in the inside. And so if you burned a candle with so much carbon dioxide produced on it, so much oxygen in with it, it melted so much ice. So that was rapid combustion. So we knew that a candle went out and it needed oxygen. And we know that the mice needs oxygen. So what if we put a guinea pig in an ice calorimeter, how much carbon dioxide would be produced and how much heat would be produced. And doing careful calculations, whereas Priestley sort of undid the photosynthesis, Lavoisier did respiration, and he said, look, this guinea pig is the same as a candle, except the candle burns more quickly, but the guinea pig burns the same amount of stuff, but more slowly. And that is, respiration is sort of slow, wet combustion, if you like, biological combustion. Now, do you promise to get back on Lavoisier? Here's a long podcast, and I've decided what I'm going to do is discuss people and stuff like that to make things interesting. Lavoisier. So Priestley is interesting. Why do Priestley and Lavoisier together? The two, you have to do the two together. One discovered deflosgenated air, and then the school books then say, he discovered oxygen. Well, it's sort of, then the students think, well, I've discovered, what's that? I've called it oxygen, and then you can't re-get into them and say, oh no, someone else named it, how does it all fit together? So you really need the two bits together. And so, as we've seen, that Priestley was sort of fell out of very conservative England, and very, you know, so much so that opportunities weren't there. Lavoisier was also, Lavoisier was in the opportunity, the upper class, the opportunity class. There you go. So he was a noble. So it's Anton Lavoisier. This is something I've always promised to do. I'm going to call scientists by their double names. So Joseph Priestley and Antoine Lavoisier. And I can't remember the wife. Oh, so let's start again. So Lavoisier, he's a noble, and he likes doing experiments. Good on you, Lavoisier. And he invests in a company, a French company, which is involved in farming. That's right, the farm. But it's actually, so it's an idea that you go out and you harvest things. And, you know, you probably wouldn't want to do this before the French Revolution, but that's the way it was happening. In a very complicated French tax system, which is very complicated, Lavoisier invested in a company, a great company, which is actually filthy, as if money grows on trees. Well, it did. It was actually a money farm. It's called, I'm not joking, it's called the tax farmer. He was a tax farmer. It wasn't that money grows on trees, money grows on peasants. So you go up to them, and there's various taxes that you could go up. And what you do is, the government was getting unpopular, so they outsourced taxation to this company. So the government was unpopular, this company would come around and bash you up and get your money from you. And so Lavoisier had, it was basically a private tax collector. Only, I think only in Europe, he was a private tax collector. And so he got involved in various things. One is controlling, so there was a salt tax. So salt was 30 times more expensive in Paris than it was in the countryside. So you can imagine, this would be a discontent stuff. And then tobacco, you had to tax tobacco. And so he, getting it under control, I think various things got under government control. And he began to look at getting quality tobacco and getting it correct, and looked at people who were adulterating tobacco, and he found that some sort of adulterations actually improved the tobacco, and adding too much moisture to bulk up the weight of the tobacco caused it to go off, but too little moisture didn't make it as good tobacco. So he he identified that, and then we have the problem of smugglers in Paris. So he supervised the building of a wall completely around Paris. So you can imagine a powder keg building up in Paris, this wall. So there'd be soldiers on the wall, and so you could tax anything going into Paris. By and by, there was gunpowder. Now, gunpowder introduced by the Chinese and rediscovered by Sir Francis Bacon. It's a combination of carbon and sulfur. So carbon burns, and sulfur is just like powdered oxygen. And then potassium nitrate, which was collected from urine. Potassium nitrate, I have to remember the process of it. So people used to collect French urine and develop the crystals. I have to remember the process, potassium nitrate. So it's KNO3, K plus NO3 minus. I can see the bonds, but I just can't remember the process. And this is the entire thing while I'm doing this cardiac rehab, is just to let the memories, so I've got so much information in there, it's a real train wreck after this rehab operation and stuff like this. Getting back to it, so you have to make gunpowder, and so if you put this noble was put in charge of it and began thorough research laboratory and actually turned the gunpowder production right around. Really good quality French gunpowder, like the ideal combination, the sort of gunpowder you need to handle revolutionaries and to France, dominate Europe. And it was so good it became a going concern industry. So you had a whole lot of chemicals going around the place, and a gunpowder factory, an army factory, and they gave Lavoisier a laboratory and a house inside the grounds of the French armory, so you could go there, and he had his various laboratories, and being very wealthy, he was well funded. But we must not forget his wife, Mary, Marie-Anne, I've got some sort of French, married her when she was 13, so he just, you know, that happened back then. And I don't think it was a very regular occurrence. And she was absolutely essential to getting into the Lavoisier world. So she cooked and entertained for the various scientists, of course, kept notes, and she was very good at different languages, and so could translate texts to and from English, so she was a great thing, and she sketched and helped all the experiments, and she was a real they were really basically co-workers, and this again occurs again and again in France, whereas the women are kept out, the women are key workers, and you can project sort of a similar process here. So the idea of a noble person visiting, it's that sort of nobility thing. So it's a bit interesting in terms of going in. Now, as I said, Marie-Anne, it's very interesting to see how that worked together, and she sketched things, and I think similarly, the sketching and drawing is also necessary. If you went back to Joseph Priestley, he also had to sketch his equipment and stuff like that. That goes up to another story of Joseph Priestley. I'm jumping in around a place. Let's just summarise the annals. So, Joseph Priestley, mouse killer. Lavoisier lost his head, but he froze a few guinea pigs in the process for science. And that sort of thing is sort of very shocking science, but it should come along. I just want to finish off with a story of, there's lots of things these people, Joseph Priestley, Hold Your Coke Up and Toast, the inventor of those bubbles, Joseph Priestley. But also, he had a problem of having to draft his three-dimensional, draw things with pencils, and he found that he could erase pencils with a chunk of Indian rubber. I don't know why it's called Indian. I think Indian rubber may actually be from the South American Indians. I have to really, really think about this Indian rubber. So he's also the inventor of the eraser. So maybe you've learned a few things. Newton, inventor of the clap flap. Priestley, mouse killer, but discovered that air was multi-component and gets awarded, and the components were distinct. And that seems to me, well, there's a bloody big possum coming across. Whoa. There's a possum which has gone up a tree by here, and it's the size of a small, not a small horse, but it's a very large one. Getting back to it. Sorry about this. You've got to keep your concentration on this. So Lavoisier marries someone half his age. When he was 26, I don't know how old he was, but a lot of strange things happening, ideal job, but obviously gets his head chopped off, and someone takes the wrong head, and the wrong head gets eventually carved into a statue, or struck into a statue. But Lavoisier is, Priestley was at the same point. You can imagine the the ancient system of Aristotle, the very first crack, you know, the real body blow came from Priestley, even though he didn't quite get there. And then once the crack had gone through, Lavoisier, who began measuring things, albeit with guinea pigs and stuff like freezing guinea pigs, and stuff like that, but actually measuring the mass of things generated that mass, the conservation of mass. He didn't actually get the full chemical equations that... Oh, you see, I think he did. It's basically a chemical reaction. It's a rearrangement of atoms. No new atoms are created in a chemical reaction. So that's a general story. And what I'm trying to do is break things up and break it from the general podcast where I just grind you through these exam questions. And of course, with the exam questions, I'm now working out how to actually set it up so you can hear the exam question, get the lecture, get the formula sheet, and do the questions, and let's move on that one. Thanks for listening, and I've just got to keep on doing my rehab and just clearing out my brain. Thanks for listening. In the meantime, keep on thinking, doing, and finally teaching science.